Good morning and welcome to Andy's Open Door. My name is Chris Thompson. I'm the Chief Medical and Transformation Officer here at MaineHealth. I'm filling in for Andy today. I'm excited to have a wonderful guest with us, Lizzie Mulcahy. Lizzie is the Senior Director of the telehealth team. Lizzie also is a family nurse practitioner and works in the adult medicine clinic at Maine Medical Center. We're going to have a great conversation about telehealth, and I know so many questions come regarding telehealth, and we're going to be able to answer them and get some clarity on the program, which is significant but also growing quickly. We also have a new face with us today. Jody Urenick is the Communications and Public Affairs Manager for the MaineHealth Medical Group and the MaineHealth Accountable Care Organization. Jody's stepping in for Caroline. Caroline Cornish is ill today, so let's take a moment. Caroline, please feel better. We're thinking of you, and at the same time, so happy to have Jody here to step in and get us through the program. And Jody, I'm going to turn it over to you in just a moment. Sure. I have one area to focus on, and that is something that we've heard about before, and that is positive patient identification. So before we turn it over to you, I want to just say we have made incredible progress on positive patient identification, and at the same time, we still have some opportunity to even be better. So we're going to continue to focus on that. Thank you for the execution, and thank you for the focus on that topic on behalf of our patients. So Jody, I'm going to turn it over to you to get us started out with some of the structure of the program.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here, and good morning, everyone. Before we begin, a few quick reminders. If you have questions for Lizzie or Chris, you can send them through the chat. Please be sure to include your first name, last name, and pronouns, as we do not ask anonymous questions. We also have some great email questions we received in advance. I'm excited to get to those. And with that, Chris, Lizzie, let's begin.
Fantastic. Lizzie, it is so great to have you here today, and thanks for your time. Can you tell us about your background?
Yeah, so my background's interesting. I think like most people who are clinicians who end up in other types of roles, I started off as a nurse. I went to nursing school directly after undergrad, and I had met a nurse practitioner during my undergrad days, and it's interesting, I was reflecting on this yesterday. What I was most attracted to about her role was actually her work-life balance. So when I met her and I understood that she had a family and she had things she liked to do out of work, that really clicked for me because I knew that there were going to be things in my life I wanted to do that were outside of my work. And so that drove me to nurse practitioner school. I have been a nurse practitioner for 10 years, and about 5 years ago, I really lucked into a role on an innovation team at a large health system in Louisiana called Ochsner Health. That expanded my whole view on what's possible in healthcare. And so for the last 5 years, I've been learning how to build and lead technology-enabled programs and care teams to take better care of our patients and our providers and clinicians.
Fantastic. What does building a virtual care team look like? How does that happen?
Yeah, so I think the first thing we always talk about is what is the problem we're trying to solve. So, we know with technology, sometimes it feels easy to just try out new technology, but if we don't have a really clear sense of what we're trying to address with either that new technology or new care team, it's going to be hard for us to make progress. So usually we start off with a problem we're trying to solve. An example of that would be our virtual same-day care team, which is led by Tracy Halbuena and Melissa Victory. And that problem we were trying to solve was access. Access in primary care, access for same-day needs. And as that problem developed, we realized that we had a great opportunity to bring in virtual care team members. So we started building out teams that included an APP or a physician and an MA. And that's a good example of how we can identify problems and then recognize that we can build these teams in a different type of way, offer a different experience for our patients and a different experience for our care team members to provide this kind of care.
Fantastic. Clearly there's a body of work that's happened in virtual care. And I know that there are lots of terms out there, and there's virtual care and telemedicine and remote patient monitoring. And I'm sure as we talk, we'll kind of touch upon pieces of all of those aspects of care. In addition to what we're doing now, what are the limits of telemedicine? Are there, and I'm sure that there's push that may change as time goes on. I think, you know, COVID changed how we look at this perhaps in a way, but we've really had a significant acceleration in the volume of care that we're providing via telehealth. So are there limits out there? Are we pushing on those limits? Is that an ongoing conversation?
I think it's ongoing, and I also think it's use case by use case. So I think sometimes it's determined by the program, sometimes it's determined by the patient or the clinician. The way we're approaching telehealth and virtual care here is not as a standalone entity. We're really talking about weaving our services into the fabric of care at MaineHealth. So we are not suggesting we replace in-person care. What we really focus on is developing smooth operations and workflows so that we can supplement our in-person care, provide, fill gaps, solve problems, maybe even do different things like remote monitoring, where we end up with daily data for our patients that otherwise we wouldn't have been able to act on or receive. So I think when I think about limits, I don't see limits. I see how do we build this care in a way so it's operationalized smoothly for our patients, for our care teams, it's safe. And I think when you approach this kind of care like that, I don't think that there are limits. I think that we just really understand the environment that we're working in.
Fantastic. We talk a lot about access for our patients. We want easy, equitable access for our patients to be able to receive care, whether it's primary care or specialty care. Talk a little bit about how telehealth and virtual care enhances our access for our patients.
Yeah, so I'll talk about this both in the hospital setting and the outpatient setting. So I'll start with hospital. Currently, there are many inpatient programs at MaineHealth that use telehealth to provide access for our patients to all different kinds of specialists across our system. We know that in Maine, sometimes we have specialists and they're one of a few or maybe the only one that's providing that kind of care for our patients in Maine and New Hampshire. And so our services, there's obviously the telestroke program, which has been live and robust for many years. There are newer programs like a tele-NICU or tele-PICU, where there's a patient who needs that specialty recommendation who's at a rural hospital. And so with these programs in place, we can have a neonatologist or a pediatric critical care physician come in via a video and help provide recommendations to that bedside team. So that's one way of access that we talk about access. On the hospital side as well, we're looking at future programs that are not as much about acute consults, but more standing access, like to a virtual nurse or maybe a lower acuity consultation like a tele-ID program that we have right now, where that bedside team can call on an infectious disease physician to help provide recommendations. On the ambulatory side, this is where we start talking about, okay, how can we build these virtual or remote teams to really help supplement our in-person teams? So the virtual same-day care program I referenced, that's one really great example. This is a brand new team at MaineHealth that we're building. Under that same leadership, there's also an in-basket team that's being built right now. And that's another really great example of how we have virtual team members that are going to help increase access for our care teams and for our patients. We also talk about remote management. And so these are programs where we are collecting data from patients at home. And sometimes we just drive that data back to a home team, depending on the volume and the acuity of the data. So an example of that is a new program for postpartum blood pressure monitoring for some of our moms that will be launching in a month or so. That's one where the data will drive back to the home team. When we talk about access there's opportunity where when we get that data, it will change the way potentially that patients interact with clinic. And so it might change some of the access in clinic if we have technology sending that data. For other programs like heart failure or general population hypertension, that's where we're building dedicated virtual teams to help manage those patients. And in time, we might be seeing impact. We will definitely see impact on quality. We will likely see impact on clinic access as those programs mature and grow.
Fantastic. You know, something that you mentioned, the inbox management, for instance. So that seems to be maybe an indication that a couple of years ago, maybe some in health systems around the country were doing that, or primary care or other clinics were doing that. But that seems like something that arose out of a need. And I'm curious, how many of the programs that we have you know, are like, all right, there's a roadmap and this is what we're going to do. And then how many kind of just come up maybe out of a need that we're unexpected and we say, oh, wow, that is something that are, that because we have a platform, we can now direct it toward that and actually help in that area.
Yeah, I think that's a great way you said that. So we do have a roadmap. We have a pretty clear roadmap, I would say, for about the next 3 years for our hospital and ambulatory programs. But once we have structure and we've built a lot of infrastructure across the team over the last many years, once we have this structure, there are many people across MaineHealth who say, wow, that would be a wonderful place to hire a virtual team who can help with InBasket. I think another great example of that are e-consults. So under the telehealth umbrella, we are responsible for operationalizing the adult side of e-consults. The Children's Health Service Line has operationalized the pediatric side. But we're working together to really think about how do we increase access between our primary care teams and specialist management. And there are many ideas that have come our way as that work has developed. And I think that's a good example of once you have that structure, it helps others think about ideas of how to use the structure. And that's what's really exciting is a lot of the work we do is really fostered by innovation from our teams all across the system. They have really great ideas, and we work very, very closely to help bring in those ideas so that we can shape the programs in the right way.
Wonderful. You just conjured a vision in my mind of, you know, being able to say, hey, we have, you know, a cart in one place. Oh, wow, we already have this infrastructure in place to be able to add on to the programs. And it makes one think of the technology, you know, telehealth and telemedicine, and clearly medicine is a technology-rich thing to do as well. But telehealth specifically involves technology, IT connectivity, you know, applications. How do we evaluate the applications, the technology, the cameras, the carts? Tell me a little bit about that ecosystem of being able to evaluate and choose and implement.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that we are continuing to learn about over time. The telehealth team, so the inpatient work on the operations side is led by Stephanie Gagne. And with our IT telehealth partners, they've developed a clinical standards group for telehealth technology where they really do very closely evaluate every new piece of technology that's coming through that we're putting into our hospitals. I think what's exciting is that right now in the market, there are so many new technologies that are coming along. And so, and there are lots of different pieces of technology. There's hardware, there's software, there's AI, there's a lot of different components. There's being able to operationalize it, right? That goes into the evaluation. So a good example is we're working on, as I mentioned, we're leaning into virtual nursing and more word will come on that in the future, but we're developing a very robust vendor evaluation process for that that involves bringing our bedside nurses in to provide feedback. And so it's a process that's developing. We're learning about it. And I think most important is making sure that we're bringing those that will be using the technology, allowing them to participate early so that we get their feedback and that will steer where we go.
As we talk about that ability and sometimes extending virtual care into our nursing environment. And we also want to focus on the well-being of our providers and our caregivers and our nurses, our physicians, our advanced practice professionals, really everybody providing care. Is telehealth and being on the receiving end of a telehealth call or the providing end of a telehealth call, is that an engaging aspect of the care that we provide? And in that, I mean, you know, are there some of our caregivers that say, wow, I think I could, you know, maybe work for 10 more years if I could have a hybrid model or if I was all telehealth? Just kind of curious about some of the...
Yeah, that's our hope, right? So, I mean, I think having worked clinically for a number of years and, you know, myself and others that I've worked with who... It's a lot, right? It's a lot to be doing that in person every day. I think the opportunity to bring some variety and a hybrid focus to one's work is really important, whether that's through the way you give care, academics. You know, there are many different ways to provide variety in your day. We would love to have telehealth be one of those ways. We already see that with some of our work with e-consults. There are examples of that, the way that the practices are operationalizing e-consults and the way they're staffing. We certainly see that for our wholly remote teams who are very much drawn to the work because of the flexibility and the ability it will give them to extend, you know, how long they might want to give care. I think a goal would be how can we make this hybrid in the future, right? So that we can give people sort of the best of both worlds and allow those that want to try out different models the ability to while still maintaining in person. So that's maybe harder to operationalize in some ways, but I think very valuable. So we'll continue to work on that.
Great. How about in terms of, and for our audience too, sometimes we talk about in general what questions we might want to talk about. And we've gone completely off script here. So I am actually asking Lizzie questions she's not expecting. So
that's okay.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Just because I'm curious. As we talk about our workforce providing telehealth services, we talk about, you know, the future of that for physicians, advanced practice professionals, nurses, and others. How does this, we clearly have a significant academic mission, and it's part of our ethos and part of how we're going to move forward here at MaineHealth. How does telehealth and virtual care expertise and competence fit into our residency, our fellowship, our training environments? Is it an expectation now as you enter the workforce in medicine and clinical medicine that this is something that you are expert at and can provide care in that way, or is that still evolving?
I don't think we're there yet where it's the expectation. I'll say Tracy Habuena, who's the medical director for the telehealth team, she's been presenting to residents for a number of years about telehealth. So when they enter our ecosystem, she starts talking to them about it. I think thinking about how we incorporate this into our training in a more systematic way is certainly something we can focus on. I think COVID, you know, because a lot of training shifted to virtual, I think it became part of many folks' training when it hadn't been previously planned on. I think there's an opportunity for us to teach people how to do this, right? I mean, remote patient monitoring is a perfect example. Many people wouldn't know how to approach having data from 100 patients come to them every day, right? How do you make decisions about management? We, for each of our programs, we provide training and we develop it as a, you know, an interdisciplinary team about how we approach that. I absolutely think that should be part of training as we move forward. I've definitely seen different schools across the country who are incorporating this into their curriculum. I think now it's becoming part of an expectation. It's something that we will continue to work on here and talk about how to approach that. But I'd say it's already started. I think it's on people's radar, and there's more that we can learn and do.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for that, Lizzie. I have just one more question for you. I know we're going to have questions coming up, and I think people have an opportunity, obviously, to ask general questions. We've had some questions submitted, and people will have a chance to ask questions to you regarding telehealth as well. But as we kind of wrap up our conversation and our questions here, what are the top three, you know, two or three questions that you get regarding telehealth? Have we asked them? And if not, what are they? What are the things that people come to you with?
Yeah, so we get a lot of questions about the legal, regulatory, compliance aspects of telehealth. It's complicated. And it often involves pulling in multiple team members to understand different cases. So we are fortunate that we just hired a program manager dedicated to helping us manage that work, Natalia Johnson. And so we get a lot of questions on that because a lot of the questions you asked, our teams want to give care in a different way. They want our care teams to experience giving care in a different way. And so they're running into some ways that they're trying to be creative with the way that they set up the care experience. And we get a lot of questions about that. We also get a lot of folks coming forward with great ideas of saying, hey, I would like to try out this type of model, or I think there's a really good opportunity there. And so we bring them through different types of intake processes depending on the type of program. So that's a question we get a lot of. And I also, we try to seek those out, right? When we hear about neat things going on and we think we might be able to bring resources and help fully integrate that, we do. So it's kind of a bi-directional relationship on that one. I think those are the two areas. Legal, regulatory, and compliance, that's a big one. We have a lot of really great team members that we work with at MaineHealth to help us understand those issues. And then I think when there are opportunities to integrate technology in this kind of care, into our practices and hospitals across the system. We work a lot with team members on being able to do that.
Great. Do we have, and we think about many of the things that you mentioned are providing care within the MaineHealth system, within our geographies. Do we interact either on the receiving end of care or the provision of care for, you know, obviously outside of Maine and New Hampshire into other states, either in New England or around the rest of the country?
Not right now. So we do have some restrictions that come both from state licensure. So it's driven by where the patient is located at the time of the encounter, as well as our malpractice insurance at MaineHealth. So that does limit us providing care to our patients who are located in Maine or New Hampshire at the time of the encounter. It's something that it's an area we'll continue to learn more about. We certainly are. We want to stay connected to our patients wherever they are, but there are things we have to do from a legal, regulatory, and compliance standpoint to be able to do so. In terms of receiving care, maybe from providers or teams outside of MaineHealth, we don't see that frequently, but it's an area that we're continuing to look into, given that we know that access is an issue in a lot of different places, and we see examples of health systems many places across the country who are partnering with outside companies to help provide care. That's certainly something that we're continuing to explore. There are lots of different ways we can be creative and provide high-quality care in partnership, so that's also an area of a big opportunity.
Great. Well, Lizzie, thank you. We still have the opportunity to ask Lizzie questions, and so we're actually going to turn to the question aspect of the program now. So, Jody, I'm going to reach out to you to help us transition.
Of course.
So thank you.
Yeah, the chat has been a bit quiet, so please send in your questions. Lizzie, I'm going to start with a couple questions, telehealth questions that we received through mail, coming from Anthony and Kim. They want to know, their practice requires that patients come in to sign, their telehealth patients come in to sign telehealth consents, consents to treat, patient rights, and more. And of course, this can present a hardship for many patients who lack transportation or more, for more reasons. Is this a MaineHealth level policy? Why can't patients come in, why can't they sign them and send them through the mail? Why can't they be available in Epic?
Yeah, so great question, and actually one that we've been working on a lot over the last 12 months. There's been a lot of work here. We are very close to having this be available in Epic through the MyChart eReg process. So that will be coming soon. There are a lot of different teams at MaineHealth that have been working on this between legal, risk, the access leadership teams, the Epic teams, compliance, and our team, as well as patient engagement for the patient-facing scripting around this. So a lot of work is going on this right now. I actually had a call early this morning about this. So we are working hard to get this available electronically to make it a lot easier for our patients and care teams.
Awesome. Perfect timing for that question then. Mm-hmm. Okay, switching gears. Chris, we had a question come in from Seth. He says, given that MaineHealth acknowledges the role of social determinants of health in determining quality of life for Maine residents, is there any plan for MaineHealth to investigate its own role in contributing to the number of ALICE individuals in the state by comparing its compensation more closely with increased cost of living? And for the audience, I didn't know this, but ALICE stands for Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed.
Yeah, Jody, thanks. And Seth, thanks for this question. This is a significant question, one that takes a lot of our time and a lot of leadership time here at MaineHealth to try to solve. And actually, for this question, thank you, first of all, for submitting this question. I've been able to get some feedback and some specifics to be able to help this, help answer this question regarding ALICE. And so if there are those that are not familiar, it's pretty easily accessible online. And these and ALICE is something that you can look at throughout the country. You can look at it in individual states, actually all 50 states, and look at an ALICE report and analysis around the country. And this becomes increasingly important, and it also becomes increasingly important for a question that I know is coming up, which is about housing. So for the moment, I'm going to leave housing out of this, but ALICE really focuses on, you know, really the economic environment that we're all experiencing, where those that, you know, in the past might have had, you know, good jobs, good salary, and no problems are now facing some challenges because of the economic environment and what we're experiencing from inflationary pressures and just the cost of you know, being able to get through our day. It also focuses on some of the social determinants of health, again, of which we know housing is one of them, but also food security. We focus on this significantly from a salary standpoint. Salary is something that we focus on significantly and have contributed hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 3 to 4 years in terms of salaries to try to make sure that we can be as competitive as possible. And there's numerous reasons for us to do so. One is clearly to get people who are with us and being able to recruit and retain and keep people here for their entire career. That's clearly a goal of ours here at Maine Health. Secondarily is just to let people, you know, live their best lives and be able to feel comfortable and be able to feel that they're, you know, safe economically when they're, you know, living their life. We continue to, you know, provide a minimum wage that's significantly higher for both for our caregivers in both the state of Maine and New Hampshire. And that is a, you know, significant benefit we want to continue to not only maintain, but continue to grow as well. There are also legislative efforts. There are legislative proposal, one being LD 2169, where the governor of Maine has been contributing to a solution via the Maine Jobs and Recovery Plan. And the next state economic development plan will include a focus on this and especially with housing as well. Maine Health is trying to find a way to make our first contribution in partnership with the developer community, and we'll go into a little bit more detail on that with the next question, I know. So this is a significant area of focus. I don't know that I'll be able to answer everyone's questions in the time that we have here, but always feel free to continue to ask questions here. You know, so there's legislative aspects to this. There's our own internal processes to try to, you know, maximize the resources that our caregivers have in the community. There's also a realization that as, you know, reimbursement continues to be challenged and something that we work on from our payers, from our state payers, from our national payers, that really is also a piece of this. And so you can imagine as we continue to raise rates and be sustainable, that we don't want that to ultimately come back and feed into this vicious cycle of then increasing prices, increasing insurance rates, which also then affects our caregivers in an adverse way. So this is an area where there's continuous focus, and it's not easy. But what a really, really good question. Thanks for asking. And again, I think it is an ongoing conversation, and it should be.
That's great. Thank you, Chris, for that. Lizzie, we had our first question through the chat. It's from Corey, and they would like to know, are you looking at specific insurance policies on the reimbursement of these telehealth visits?
Yes, so there are many teams at Maine Health who are looking at this. It's an ever-changing landscape. So we have a good understanding of what government payers will do for a set period of time. The commercial payers are a little harder because their policies can change. So we do have team members that are looking at this and watching this, and that's in our spirit of really also wanting to increase access, it's that balance, right, of understanding what does the payer environment look like and how important is this care for our patients and our care teams to be able to provide that care. So I'd say we do have many teams at Maine Health that are watching those policies and providing a report out on a monthly basis.
That's great. Thank you, Lizzie. Chris, another question for you from Sarah. She said, I've heard a lot about our system bed and capacity issues and constraints. Anecdotally, it has been stated that lack of safe place to discharge is a significant driver of these long-term stayers. Research shows that high rates of chronic homelessness leads to increased ED use and longer inpatient hospital stays, which in turn raises healthcare costs. Speaking to social determinants of health have been identified as a balanced scorecard goal. What action is Maine Health considering to address this growing problem? Are we considering partnering with Maine Housing on any upcoming initiatives?
Thanks for that question. Sarah, thanks for that question. There's a lot in the question that you just asked, and it has to, you know, really focus on one of our core missions, which is getting people, giving people the support to live their best life. So we don't want people to be in the hospital longer than they have to be. We want them to be home. We want them to, again, have a home to be able to experience life outside of the hospital. So that's the kind of foundational aspect of your question, and that is an area of significant focus for us. When we talk about being able to accomplish that, being able to, you know, keep people in the acute care setting for their stay, but ultimately getting them to either a post-acute care facility, skilled nursing facility, long-term care facility, or home, one of our biggest challenges right now is the post-acute care environment. So, you know, we definitely have it, and those that are discharging patients, our care managers, our caregivers know that on a daily basis, we're having challenges with skilled nursing, long-term care, and getting patients to those areas. So there is significant focus on that. To focus directly on your question, which was housing, the area that we're looking at is really between what we'd call affordable housing, where there might be subsidized housing, really for those living at the poverty level or near the poverty level. And then at the other aspect of housing is really market-based housing. So, hey, the market has a price for housing in areas of Maine and New Hampshire because it's such a desirable place to be. Those rates and those costs have gone up. It's hard to afford. Even for those who previously, maybe a few years ago, wouldn't have had a problem, this is a different time for sure. There's also the in between that, and something that we call workforce housing. So those are those individuals that earn a good salary, but just because of the economic environment might have difficulty. And that is where there's significant focus. I'll add in a little bit of my previous experience in healthcare, and coming from Colorado, where we had areas that were in ski areas and just areas where housing costs ballooned, you know, not unlike we're experiencing here in New England, but really ballooned to a point where people couldn't afford it at all. And as a healthcare system jumped in and tried to actually build housing and develop housing, I just want to say it's very difficult. So building housing, developing housing is a specialized area that people have particular expertise in, and increasingly, thankfully, have expertise in the workforce housing that we're talking about, being able to provide affordable, good housing for those who are simply affected by the economic environment. The answer is yes, we do have teams that are partnering, that are receiving proposals, that are working to generate joint proposals with those experts in the developer field to be able to look at workforce housing and housing that's more affordable. Obviously, not only for our patients that we want to be able, you know, that have a job, that are working, that want to get back to work and want to be able to afford a home, but also for our own caregivers in the same way. So, yes, that is a definite area of focus. It will be an area that will continue to, be challenging. There's no doubt. But an area that we're committed to and an area that we're focused on, as long as we don't try to independently extend our work to becoming developers. We want to make sure that those are partnerships with the experts that are good at it, and have that skill set.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Makes perfect sense. Another question for you from Chelsea. She says, given many struggling with student loans, I was wondering if there have been any discussions about Section 110 for the Secure 2.0 Act and implementing at Maine Health, which allows employers to provide 403B matching for qualified student loan payments. This, of course, would address the challenge of paying back student loans and could benefit retention and recruitment.
Yeah, thank you, Judy. Thanks for that question as well. That is also a really, really good question. And I think you explained it really well. Essentially, this act allows matching payments that were going to a retirement account for our caregivers to instead be directed towards student loans. We are not doing that as of today. And there's a couple reasons. Number one, philosophically, Maine Health has been really, really focused on providing retirement benefits for our caregivers. We feel like it's really important. And that in itself does not mean that we won't continue to evaluate this opportunity to redirect payments or redirect matching payments and matching funds into retirement accounts, redirecting them to student loan payments. Also, our financial partner, Lincoln, has not yet implemented this. And it may seem simple to just, you know, take funds and move it from one place to another. But when we begin dealing with retirement accounts and student loan payments, there is a huge infrastructure to be able to do that. So our partner does not yet have that capability. So wonderful question, something that will be reevaluated on an ongoing basis, but not something that we're doing today.
Thanks, Chris. I want to stay on the topic of benefits, specific menopause benefits. A question came in from Elizabeth. She says, does Maine Health offer any menopause benefits to menopausal employees beyond the standard counseling and providers we can see? This is an increased trend with companies now expanding support. Can you answer that?
I absolutely can. And, awesome. And with help from some of my colleagues, I can help to answer that. So I have our HR team help to weigh in here, so I'll appreciate them. Awesome. Wonderful question. We continue to evaluate these opportunities to support inclusive benefits as this program outlines. Our current vendor is Progyny, and it's developing enhancements to deliver focused menopausal benefits in the near future. So please stay tuned. And thanks to the HR team for helping me with that question.
Yeah, we had to telephone a friend for that one. So thanks to our HR team. Chris, another question. Are there any plans to align the Maine Health Medical Group with the hospitals? This question came in from Liz. She's asking because outpatient practices report up to the Maine Health Group Medical Group leadership, but inpatient hospital-based service lines have their own service lines. So the relationship just seems a bit disconnected to her. So I was hoping that you could expand upon that.
What a wonderful question. And Liz, thanks for asking it. Yes, there is. Let me even step back for a moment and just say one of the great joys for me being here, I know for everyone that comes here, you know, people talk about the academics, they talk about the teaching mission, talk about the clinical mission, all being really tightly interwoven. And I think in those, we have some just amazing programs. I think about, you know, our research programs. I think about our structures, our departmental structures, primarily based at Maine Medical Center, but ultimately, you know, continuing to grow across the health system. I think about the rapid translation of academics and research into the clinical care that we provide in terms of translational medicine and an actual area of our research program devoted to that. And those are really, really powerful pieces of our healthcare system that are central. And at the same time, I'll say it does introduce, you know, a lot of different, you know, what to call it, I guess, buckets that our clinical teams and our research teams fall into. So we have departmental structures and we have growing service lines. We have obviously a growing medical group, and all these are happening at the same time. What we're all experiencing is all of those growing, developing capabilities all at the same time. And yes, there is a lot of active discussion around how to streamline. And so the streamlining is important, number one, because all of those different entities, whether we're talking about ambulatory or acute care, oftentimes have administrative infrastructures to them that might be doing duplicative work, and we don't want that to happen. We want this to be streamlined. We want decisions that are made, you know, again, in the ambulatory world or in the acute care environment to be done in a way that can be streamlined, that can occur quickly, where decision rights are clear cut. And there clearly is a simplification process to that moving forward. So first of all, let me acknowledge the question is a really, really good one and one that we're devoting a lot of focus on. More to come.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris. We have two more questions after I read this one. It is a bit long, so I am going to read it. But if you have any questions for Lizzie regarding telehealth or for Chris, please send them in through our chat. We still have some time. So Chris, this one is from Julie. It's about prior authorization. So she would like to know, prior authorizations is known as a pain point in healthcare. The Maine Health Medical Group has exceptional staff. Every day working uphill against the rising cost of care we all want to provide. Our leadership is working tirelessly to find solutions within a complex system. What can frontline caregivers do to help work with our legislative partners to require insurers to make prior authorizations a more reasonable process? We know this is a priority for MaineHealth, and they would love to share the burden of moving our legislators to take action. In an era of unprecedented profit for our insurers, we see the need to push for reasoned and regulated policies to obtain needed care for our patients.
Julie, also, thank you for this question. These questions are all very active questions and actually really important questions, so appreciate it. I also had some help on this one from our government affairs team to bring me up to the most updated. I am involved in a lot of this work, but also wanted to have the most updated information on the relationship between what's happening legislatively and what's happening at MaineHealth. So I am going to read a bit, and this is a complex area. The question was great, and so if you'll give me just a couple moments, I want to update the organization on what's happening in that regard. So this has been a priority for years, and just last week on February 28th, a legislative committee voted along party lines in support of the bill that MaineHealth worked on with the Maine Medical Association, which had the following key characteristics. Number one, it requires insurance carriers to publicly report data, including the items and services that require a prior authorization and the number of prior authorizations that were denied, aggregated by item and service, and specifically by carrier. The second key component, it allows providers to appeal on behalf of the patient. Third component, for non-emergency services provided without a required prior authorization, a carrier can't deny the claim pending medical necessity review, but they can impose a 15% penalty on the provider. And this is huge because currently the carriers deny the claim and don't pay us at all. And we can't balance bill the patient, so we eat the entire cost of the service and procedure. And we often still provide the care because that's why we're here. We worry about payment sometimes second, but this will help that those denials or those lack of authorizations, forgive me. Next, prior authorizations will now be good for 14 days before and 14 days after a scheduled procedure and service. So if for some reason the procedure can't be performed on the originally scheduled date, the provider doesn't need to resubmit the prior authorization. And lastly, for post-evaluation or post-stabilization services after an emergency service, the carriers must respond to a prior authorization within 24 hours, and the care must be paid for during those first 24 hours. So those are the key provisions of what a lot of this work has gone into and accomplished. This applies only to plans regulated by the legislature, so not self-funded plans like MaineHealth's or Medicare Advantage plans, but a significant advancement in that process. We know that this is time-consuming, it's onerous, it oftentimes is frustrating. There's likely a lot more work to do. Thank you for everyone involved in these processes because they are important to make us a sustainable healthcare system and provide the needed services that our patients need. This is a movement forward, but no doubt there will be a continued focus. So Julie, thank you for that question.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. We have one question from Katie. Katie would like to know, she's heard from some other sites that individual celebrations like appreciation weeks or specific profession appreciations are going away. And they have a lot of teams that have appreciation weeks to recognize, and they do it throughout their practice. And she's wondering, is this going away this week that our team is? They look forward to this every year, and they want to celebrate it in many different ways. So she's hoping that we can get some clarification on recognitions.
Yeah, Jody, thank you. And Katie, thank you for the question as well. Beginning in 2024, MaineHealth will sponsor a system-wide recognition week, which will occur from May 6 to 12. This will provide a unified opportunity for us to recognize all care team members, regardless of discipline, for their incredible work. At the same time, we recognize that leaders and teams may want to celebrate other national recognition weeks, holiday celebrations, or entity or team-based awards, and we want to provide guidance so these can continue and so that they're generally equitable across MaineHealth. You'll be hearing more about this in the coming weeks, but our new guidance will absolutely encourage local celebrations and recognitions of teams and team members, and will encourage leaders to focus on more of the experiential ideas you mentioned, like decorating our KPI boards and themes. Recognizing colleagues across not just our own teams, but others too, will be a key element of this team's CARE Team Appreciation Week. So again, thank you for the team that provided me with this latest update, but we absolutely want to provide a support for all of these recognitions, which are incredibly important and valued, and also provide some equitable equitability and an element of structure, but freedom within a framework to continue local celebrations and determine how you want that to happen, and again be able to thrive in that environment within that framework.
Thanks, Chris. We have one more question before we transfer over to recognitions, and this is from Candace. She's wondering, the recent changes the CDC made to their quarantine as of March 1st, they have changed it to be all-encompassing, where all respiratory viruses, such as flu or the RSV, you should stay home when you are sick based on your symptoms and not return unless you're fever-free for 24 hours without over-the-counter medications. This is consistent with our policy prior to COVID. Will Maine Health also be adopting the CDC guidelines? She's curious because she said her child's school has already adopted these guidelines and communicated the change.
Yeah, great question. And I think what the foundation of that question, which is very good, really refers to something that's been called COVID exceptionalism. And COVID exceptionalism has said, hey, you know, we're going to make decisions based upon COVID illness and burden of COVID illness and rates of COVID illness in the community only, and not necessarily consider influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, and other influenza-like illnesses that are occurring. And so that is something that has been obviously recently updated. Our respiratory viruses work group is the team that is helping us and guiding us through a lot of these decisions. They're absolutely dedicated. Dr. Dan Dikema chairs this committee, which is really comprised of some of our experts across the organization. We also are adhering to trying to move away from COVID exceptionalism. And in fact, as everyone knows, we initiated a masking process recently that is being followed very closely by our respiratory work group. And we at Maine Health as leadership are taking the respiratory work group's recommendations frequently and as we determine what next steps are. As of the most recent meeting of the respiratory work group, some of the COVID volumes and burden has gone down. Some of the respiratory syncytial virus has gone down. Influenza has maintained to be a significant problem. So for the moment, it is sort of acting as the driver of our influenza-like illness decision-making. So hopefully, and I want to say hopefully what we'll see is a decrease in that. Seems like there might be some trends that are going to lead to that outcome and that trend. And if that occurs, hopefully we'll be able to be seeing a change in that masking process and that masking recommendation very soon.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Lizzie. What a great conversation today. It was so fun to be here and join you all. And now we're going to kick off with recognitions. Lizzie, take it away.
All right. So I wanted to start off with recognizing the telehealth team. And so this, I want to call out, this picture is from the end of 2022. And what we've seen since then is quite a bit of growth. But this is a picture of many of the members of the operations side of the telehealth team at a quarterly retreat, and they are a phenomenal group working so hard every day and really committed to our mission at Maine Health. I also want to say this is a good reason for us to get together. Our team is hybrid. You know, we are, depending on the role, we work in different capacities in person, and so we have folks that live all across the state and outside of Maine and New Hampshire, and so I wanted to just recognize them here and thank them for all of their great work. And we need to get together with our larger team soon to take a repeat picture.
All right, we're going to move on to our next appreciation. And there's nothing like hearing from patients. And the next two of these appreciations are going to be just that. We're going to start out with Southern Maine Healthcare Internal Medicine and an appreciation for Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Carpenter is an amazing provider. I can't say enough positive things about her. She is so personable, and I always look forward to seeing her for my appointments. She's gentle and makes me comfortable. Dr. Carpenter goes above and beyond to make me feel important and uses her knowledge to try to figure out what might be going on. She even gave me some books to educate me on a condition. I highly recommend her as a primary care physician. Thank you. Wonderful. Next is directed towards our main medical partners, orthopedics and sports medicine department. And here we go. At my age of 71, it's more common than not for me to wonder if doctors actually see me for who I really am. To be perfectly clear, I've never felt that way about Dr. Bigasinski, forgive me. In all of my appointments with him, he has listened carefully, been very thorough with his examinations, and explained his findings in language I understand without making me feel like a child. His treatment options come across as very respectful, including researching the best physical therapy treatment at locations closest to me. I will never forget his compassion and the time he took with me in an appointment a few months ago. I appreciate Dr. Bigasinski's professional expertise and want to also acknowledge his caring side. I feel very fortunate to have him as my doctor. Well, thanks, everyone. The next open door is on March 20 at Maine Behavioral Health. Andy Muller will be back, and really appreciate everyone spending some time with us this morning. Hopefully, have a great rest of your day and rest of your week.